The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the first Monday Space Show program for May. And it is great to be here. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in to another gorgeous day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. Let me get through the announcements so we can start our most interesting upcoming discussion. For those of you that would like to call us today and talk to our guest, who I'll introduce in just a minute, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So remember, there are no call screeners. Let the phone ring and I'll answer it and bring you up on the air as quickly as possible. We do hold guests over the break, if applicable, and if you're calling and we're on break, I do answer the phone on break, usually put you on hold and you can hear everything, and then when we start the second segment, you're the first caller up. So again, 1-866-687-7223. Of course, you can continue to use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, which is also our website. So do check it out. Remember, all of our programs are archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily download the programs. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of new menus on our new website that we never had before, so make sure you check them out. The upper menu in the upper left side has lots of information, new links, and links to some of the older things that you've seen before. So do explore. And then on the right side, we've got recent shows, which this show will go into as soon as it ends. And then upcoming shows. Remember, upcoming shows, as soon as a program appears there, that is the blog for the show. So you can start posting, even if the show is going to be on Friday and today is Monday. You can start commenting or asking questions right there at that time. And then, of course, you can do that real time during the program, and I will see your real-time comments and questions and can direct them to our guest. And then, of course, once the show is archived, that is the blog for our show. We're no longer using a separate blog. And hopefully you won't have any problems, but if you do, please let me know. If you find items that don't work on the new website, we're still doing a little bit of troubleshooting left. Please call them to our attention. There is a store on our website. It's in the upper left-hand menu corner, so do check that out. There's lots of Space Show logo items there that may interest you. And then, of course, support the Space Show. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we're only able to bring you these programs because many of you do make financial contributions to the show. If you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction given our nonprofit status. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer, as we are actually a California public benefit corporation. Check us out at our parent, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Or just email me if you have questions, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we are copyrighted and trademarked. You are certainly welcome to and encouraged to share our programs with people that you think should learn about space, are interested in it, need to be interested in it, or you're trying to get them interested in it. Typical show is 25 megabytes. It's a little hard to send out by email. But you can use a lot of different free programs to do that. But you can also just give interested people the URL and direct them to download the program in question. And again, if you have any questions about doing that, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. There are hardly any rules attached to that, but there are 3 golden rules. So one is, don't do anything commercial with these programs. Number two is the really big golden rule. Maybe it's the platinum rule. And that is you don't edit or clip or cut the shows or segments of the show and then put the clips up on YouTube to support your ideas, your agendas, your fantasy, your work, whatever. That is strictly a no-no, and you should not be doing that. And then the third rule is no written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And we urge you to read the copyright statement in full at the bottom of every spaceshow.com website page and also onegiantleapfoundation.org page. If you have any questions or want to request something special, just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com and let's see if we can work it out. We do have new sponsors for the Space Show, and you can see their banner ads going across our homepage. And do stop at those banner ads from time to time and look at them. Without those sponsors, we would not be having a Space Show. And so we appreciate that. The first segment of our program today is brought to us by Integrated Space Analytics, who have produced the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart of how to become a truly spacefaring race. They say see how technologies and destinations build upon one another and explore the hundreds of individual elements in detail on their website, which is thespaceplan.com. Join them at ISDC in San Juan, Puerto Rico on May 19th as their principals, Jay Whitner, Ron Jones, and Gary Bigford, are going to be having an integrated space plan, bunch of activities at NSS and at their booth. You can register for the conference and get more information at nss.org, and our Friday show is devoted to ISDC 2016. The Integrated Space Plan is useful, an inspiring tool, and it should be on the wall of everyone serious about the space development process going on in the country right now. So again, check them out at thespaceplan.com. And Orbital ATK is also a first half sponsor today, a global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and is a partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And we certainly thank Orbital ATK for their support. So I'm happy to welcome back to the show Dr. Dan Derda. He is a fellow and a former member of the Board of Trustees of the International Association of Astronomical Artists. His space art has appeared in numerous magazines, web stories, and books, and has been internationally exhibited. He is also co-author of a book and published dozens of articles popularizing planetary science and the human exploration of space. He is also the PI in the Department of, well, I guess I should say the principal scientist in the Department of Space Studies of the Southwest Research Institute's Boulder, Colorado office. He has more than 20 years of experience researching the collisional and dynamic evolution of main belt and near-Earth asteroids, volcanoids, Kuiper belt comets, and interplanetary dust. He is an active pilot with time logged in over a dozen types of aircraft. This includes the Hornet, the F-104 Starfighter, and he was a finalist in the 2004 NASA astronaut selection process. He's a flight astronomer for the Airborne Astronomical Imaging System flown aboard NASA and military high-performance and high-altitude aircraft, and he has spent over 110 minutes of time in zero-G conducting experiments on the KC-135. He is also one of three Southwest Research Institute's payload specialists who will fly on multiple suborbital space flights with Virgin and X-Core once they start flying. He's an experienced cave diver, holds multiple scuba and cave diving certifications, including full cave and cave recovery specialists. He enjoys hiking in the wilderness of the Rockies, photography, birding, and paleontology. He is a National Rifle Association basic pistol instructor and has extensive training in tactical pistol and rifle. And good for you, Dr. Derda. I'm a scuba diver and a private airplane pilot, nothing compared to what you fly, other than sort of weird seaplanes that I used to fly in the San Francisco Bay before the insurance got to be prohibitive. But it's great to have you back on the show. How are you?
Hey, David. Great to be back with you. Well, you're ahead of me. I've never flown a seaplane, so that's something I've never done.
Well, it would take you all about 90 seconds to figure out how to do it.
I suspect a little bit more than that. From what I have seen, it's a bit of a complex thing. So cheers to you for mastering that.
Well, actually, it's pretty easy. It's not much more difficult than a Cessna, unless you have really calm, a calm day where there's absolutely no water movement, because then you can't tell the difference between the horizon and the water. So you fly into the water rather than, you know, letting it sort of
something
glide out.
One would tend to like to avoid, I would imagine, yeah.
No, but, I mean, you're supposed to fly into the water. So you actually hit the water rather than flaring out and coming down like you normally would if you see chop on the water. Because then you can actually tell where the water is. But when it's really glary and the sea is just as calm as you can be, you can't tell where it starts and the horizon ends. So that's pretty cool, but it just requires paying a little bit more attention. So, and hopefully you're a good swimmer.
Well, yeah, with the scuba diving, that kind of comes with that.
So you were the principal investigator of a recently flown microgravity experiment on Blue Origin, which seems to be
fantastic. You know, Blue's really been on a wonderful roll here in the last several months. They've you go to space and you come back with that vehicle, then you go to space and you come back with that vehicle again, and then you go to space and come back with that vehicle a third time. And that was the flight we were on back I think it was a month ago today, in fact, April 2nd. One of the first of the Pathfinder payload flights, basically. There's a group of us, a small cadre of us folks who are interested in suborbital research and outreach that have been working with Blue Origin as sort of pathfinders, as they're, you know, feeling their way through the commercial process and learning how to work with research customers. It's probably good for them to have a little bit of practice with that with some folks. And so a few of us stood up to be volunteers and guinea pigs to help them through that process. And in return for, you know, getting the opportunity for a very early flight. And worked out fantastically. It was a really great experience. And we had really good success. The vehicle flew perfectly and our experiment worked great, too.
How many minutes of suborbital time did your experiment get?
So that depends on the altitude that Blue flies, but most of these commercial entities now that are doing these suborbital flights are all getting just about the same, because they're all flying to about the same altitudes initially, at least, and that's somewhere between about 3 and 4 minutes of zero G. In my case, with BOR, B-O-R-E, it's an acronym, excuse me, for the Box of Rocks experiment. I'm an asteroid guy. I'm pretty interested in understanding the processes that go on the surfaces of these little objects. You know, we're going to be out there exploring them. For sure, we're already doing that, and we're going to be entering this phase of poking and prodding them robotically and trying to understand what their surfaces are like. And eventually, we're going to be out there in person doing this. And I think it behooves us to better understand that very low microgravity surface geology that occurs on these little worlds. When you're on a little world that's not much bigger than, a small town or a large building, in many of these cases, the gravity is so low there that we really don't have any intuitive process, understanding for understanding the processes that go on these little objects like that. I mean, we grow up, as human beings, as individuals, as a species, here on this 1G world, and we know how geology works here. But when you start dialing down gravity to the point where other important forces may come into play, electrostatics and self-cohesive forces between mineral grains and things like that, there are good reasons to expect that some of the things that go on in geology, like just something as simple as forming an angle of repose in a pile of debris. You take your little shovel and your bucket to the beach on a nice warm day, and you fill your bucket with sand and you pour that sand out back on the beach, it makes a nice pile. That pile looks the same here on the Earth, looks the same on the Moon, looks the same on Mars. Any place you've got anything that's, like a gravity field that we're used to, the physical processes of piling those sand grains up makes the same kind of a pile. You get a, slope angle of about 30 degrees-ish, something like that, and that's just a function of the sand, not the gravity. But when you go to a world where there's almost no gravity, you dial it down to the point where now the electrostatic attraction between the sand grains or the other, other types of self-cohesive forces that might come into play, it might be that you can start piling up grains in a different way. And so we have, we haven't gained the intuitive field geology level of understanding of those kinds of processes on these little objects. And so the only way to start to get at that beyond you know, sort of the numerical and analytical calculations that you can make, is to go out there and actually start doing some of those experiments in the relevant environment. And the suborbital flight offered that to me, so it was great.
Does 3 to 4 minutes give you enough time to really collect good data?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. We get great data. People are lining up by the hundreds every year to go fly parabolic aircraft, zero-G aircraft, to go and get, you know, maybe 20, 23, 25 seconds of zero-G at a time to do their investigations. And a lot of good stuff gets done that way. But there are classes of investigations that you can't do in that limited time frame. Anything that takes more than about 20, you know, maybe even more like about 15 seconds by the time you stabilize out and are able to do the experiment. Any experiment, any investigation that needs time scales, you know, that's looking at a phenomenon that takes longer time scales than that, you can't do it. You can use those environments for testing and getting your experiment ready for a longer flight, but you can't do the full range of the investigation. So yeah, 3 or 4 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes even, put you into a whole new realm of type of investigation that you can, you know, that the thing that you can start to do. Also, the fact that on a true suborbital flight outside of the atmosphere, you've got much cleaner microgravity. You don't have those turbulent perturbations that you do in an aircraft. Any passenger flying across the country, you know, on a passenger aircraft is familiar with turbulence. That same sort of turbulence will affect the parabolic path of a microgravity aircraft. A parabolic aircraft. And so that gives you perturbations at the hundredth of a G level, let alone milligravity or microgravity that we're interested in for these little objects. So
let me back you up. You're talking about turbulence once you're in space or while you're going through the atmosphere.
In the atmosphere on a parabolic aircraft. Now,
okay.
When you're on a suborbital vehicle, once you're you're clear of the atmosphere. By definition, you're flying up above the sensible atmosphere on a parabolic flight, like we just did with Blue Origin. On a suborbital flight, like we just did with Blue Origin, you're outside of the turbulent effects of the atmosphere. And so the microgravity, the level of microgravity, the cleanliness, if you will, of the microgravity is much better. And so you've got the opportunity to have a much cleaner experiment from that perspective. And so that's another benefit. So you got a little bit more time on a suborbital flight. You've got cleaner microgravity on a suborbital flight. So there's a lot of great opportunities.
So what did Bohr actually do with this, with rocks? What was its mission?
Yeah, so it's the Box of Rocks experiment. It was started basically. I was reviewer, a peer reviewer of a scientific paper that was submitted years ago on some of the results from the Hayabusa spacecraft investigation of the asteroid Itokawa. Little near Earth asteroid. And one of the paper I was reviewing was interested in looking at the shape distribution of all the blocks and boulders, all the craggy, rocky fragments on the surface of that little asteroid. And there was some discussion in there about actually determining the shape distribution of those rocks from the spacecraft images. And it got me to thinking about the fact that, but can we really recover the full three-dimensional size distribution of those rocks when you're only really seeing a two-dimensional projection of their randomly jumbled, you know, assortment there on the surface from a particular spacecraft image? And it just got me to thinking about this process of recovering the 3D shape distribution from a 2D image. And so I got the opportunity, excuse me, was just beginning to do this flight with Blue Origin, and it struck me that it was a good opportunity to put a regolith simulant, some fragmented rocks, and some regularly shaped rocks, rocks that I knew the true 3D shape distribution of, put them literally in a box, light them up with lights, and just video them, video their behavior as they jostle and settle in microgravity and during the reentry process. And so that was the origin of the Box of Rocks experiment. It's basically... actually, it's not even taking advantage of the 3 or 4 minutes of microgravity. It's actually taking most advantage of those several seconds at the very end of the suborbital part of the flight where you're just now re-entering the sensible atmosphere and just starting to pile on the micro-Gs, the milli-Gs, as the air is becoming thicker and thicker. And as that's happening, you're approaching those sorts of gravity levels that some of these smaller asteroids have. And so it was actually not so much taking advantage of the microgravity, it was taking advantage of the very clean onset of very low gravity to watch the settling of these rocks and get the video images of their final, you know, rested configuration, so I can now go back and measure a, you know, box of known rocks of known shapes and see how the derived shape distribution compares with the real one. So it's a way to understand the regolith of little asteroids and the settling processes in that, case.
What kind of rocks do you pick to be representative of the regolith?
I'll tell you that story associated with another space payload of mine that I'm a co-investigator on that just launched up to the space station about the same time that the that Bohr flew on Blue Origin. In the case of the Blue Origin flight, we flew. There were two boxes in the investigation in the payload. One box had literally nothing more than just ceramic bricks. Bricks of a known rectangular shape and just some artificial ceramic material. That was kind of my control, if you will, for the experiment. The other box contained just a jumble of natural terrestrial rock, but naturally fragmented. So they had that random distribution of broken up shapes. The composition of the rock wasn't as important as the fact that it was just a natural, a selection of naturally fragmented rock. So I had the control of the regularly shaped ceramic blocks, and then I had the sort of more, readily compared to the actual asteroidal data collection of broken up rocks. So we have the data in hand. The video looks fantastic, and I'm just about now to start into the deep analysis of the actual video data. But I can tell you the data I've seen are wonderfully clean. They're perfect data.
Are you going to do more of these type of experiments?
You bet. We're going to fly box of rocks again. Actually, Bohr is one of three of Southwest Research Institute's suborbital payloads that we have designed, developed, and built, and tested, actually, for flight on our Virgin Galactic flights, our X-Corps aerospace flights, and I'm hoping also with some future Blue Origin flights as well. So we chose... You know, we're earlier adopters, right? Alan Stern, the New Horizons principal investigator, the same Alan Stern, is the principal investigator of our commercial suborbital program here at Southwest Research Institute. And, as early adopters, we're out there, trying to help, show the community, show our colleagues the fact that you can, the utility of these commercial reusable suborbital vehicles, not just for tourism and, adventure tourism and things like that, but as research platforms. And so we developed very early on three payloads, one to take advantage of the microgravity, the low gravity conditions, that's effectively Bohr, another to take advantage of the opportunity of viewing the outside universe beyond our planet from outside the disturbing effects of the atmosphere, either from turbulence or light scattering, or to be able to take advantage of the fact that you're now out, you're no longer filtering away all the infrared and the ultraviolet and things like that. So we have our Southwest imaging system that we've also flown, and that was during the intro you mentioned about flying in the F-18 Hornet and the Starfighter and things like that. Part of the reason for doing those flights was to take airborne this very same imaging system that we're now going to be flying suborbitally.
Cool.
And then there's a third payload, which is going to be we ourselves, as physiological, human bodies up there, in this sort of a, interesting launch environment. We ourselves, we wired up with biomedical harnesses to monitor the response of our bodies as we're flying. And that's of interest to our life sciences colleagues who are going to be, able to gather data from a wide range of different body types and, medical health histories and things like that. So anytime any of us fly, we should be considering helping out our human physiology science colleagues as well. So those are our three payloads, and Bohr was one of those. And definitely we're going to be flying Bohr again.
Are you taking bets on when you'll actually get to fly?
When the flight providers are ready. That's our favorite question we get, when are you going to fly? The answer I like to give is when they are ready to safely fly.
Well, do you have any inside track information on that?
Quite frankly, I have to tell you, it's kind of like, when are we going to go to Mars? It's been 20 years for the last 50 years. The answer I've been sort of you know, historically been giving people at any given time is in about 2 years or so, probably, is when we'll get a chance to fly. That's been the answer for about 5 or 6 or 7 years, but you know, that's okay. I'm a patient fellow in that regard, and you know, of course, I'm, you know, looking forward to flying. It's going to be a great opportunity, but you know, we'll fly when they're ready to fly.
Do you care which vehicle you fly on?
Whichever one is, you know, no, I mean, they're, I was going to say whichever one is good and safe and ready to fly.
Now,
always. But no, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to get the different experiences flying on, you know, because, you know, Virgin's launch, you know, flight profile, their way of getting into suborbital space is different than Blue Origin's. And that's different than X-Core Aerospace's. Or, you know, you name the company. I think it's a good thing that there's all that interesting competition going on because we don't know, I think, yet, which is going to be the most, you know, cost-effective, most reliable, most, you know, you name it, way of getting up there. And so it's going to, you know, just from a pilot perspective, as somebody who's, you know, test flown a lot of different types of vehicles, from my perspective, it's just going to be interesting to get that experience on a whole bunch of different types of platforms.
Are you planning to be a pilot on one of those craft?
I would love to be, but I don't believe I have the level of, you know, flight, you know, the type of flight test experience to pilot one of those vehicles. I would be perfectly happy. I know I'm fully capable of kind of working in the flight test engineer level, being somebody who's helping fly the vehicle or helping, you know, gather data during a flight, an early flight of a vehicle like that. But you want a former test pilot. You want a former, you know, former military pilot with 20,000 hours in, you know, in high performance vehicles doing all the flight tests and things like that to be, it's a very energetic, a very dynamic environment. And, you want the darn best pilot you can find. And, you know, the comforting thing from a customer perspective, from somebody who is going to be putting their pink little body into one of these vehicles, it's very comforting to me, working very closely with all of these companies, to see that they have that same, you know, attitude about safety and putting the very best people they possibly can in control. So, you know, we've worked with them enough that I feel very comfortable from that regard.
You have an email from Carl, who's in Tacoma. This is the first one of the day. And he says, will you be doing your science research missions at the same time people will be flying on this vehicle for space tourism reasons?
Very likely, yes. You know, it's going to overlap, I think, Carl. At Southwest, part of our reasoning getting in early was to be early adopters, and we are going to be, I think, on some of the very earliest flights once, you know, some of these companies like Virgin or X-Corp are ready to take, you know, paying passengers effectively flying. We're going to be some of the very first ones on there. But that's going to be happening at about the same time that some of those first paying passengers who are going for tourism reasons, adventure tourism, are going to be flying. The interesting, I think, decision points are going to be on a vehicle, let's say, for instance, like a Virgin Galactic vehicle, where you've got the capability of flying up to 6 passengers on that vehicle. Are you going to be trying to do serious scientific research as a researcher on board a vehicle with 4 or 5 other tourist passengers who are maybe going to be popping bottles of champagne, you know, the equivalent of that? Is that the right environment to be on, or do you want to have a dedicated science flight where everybody else on the vehicle is also doing research? These are, I think, decisions yet to be made by us. There are decisions yet to be made by those flight providers. So we're going to see how that evolves. But, yeah, we're going to be up there very early on and probably, you know, on the very next flight after us or maybe just the first flight before us, there might have been a paying, you know, space tourist flying as well.
Another one for you is from Rhonda in Austin, Texas. And she says, my understanding is that Blue flies by remote control without a pilot. Does that bother you, given that you are a pilot? Are you going to be comfortable in an automatically flown vehicle?
Well, that's a good question, Rhonda. Yeah, it's you know, I know there are some folks who kind of shy at that a little bit. I can tell you, though, having worked very closely with Blue and seeing, you know, the what their vehicle is capable of doing, it's that doesn't really bother me. You've probably already been on a commercial aircraft where, yes, there's a pilot on board, but I'll bet you, having flown a lot of these vehicles myself, the way it works, that pilot for that 2-hour flight was probably only actively at the controls, you know, actually flying the vehicle for maybe about 10 minutes of that flight. Most of the rest of the time, it was already under pretty much automatic and robotic control, all the way, in some cases, all the way down to the touchdown on the runway itself.
Yeah, but he was right there to override.
Yeah, but it's sure, of course, and that's a valid point. There's no doubt about it. But it's just showing you that the technologies really are getting to the point where, I mean, you know, we're having automobiles that are almost ready to be driving themselves on the road. So several years ago that may have bothered me more than it does now, and it may have bothered me a little bit more if I had not already have been seeing the capabilities of vehicles like New Shepard that Blue Origin is flying. I'd hop in that vehicle in a second if they asked me to.
So you just sent something called the Sapphire module up to the space station, and you're involved with that project as well, correct?
Yeah, just about a month ago again, I think it was back on March 22nd, Orbital ATK launched one of their resupply missions, crew resupply missions up to the space station. Cygnus module went up. And in addition to bringing up fresh oranges and all that kind of great stuff that the crew likes to get, there were several science payloads, science investigations on board, again, taking advantage of the nice research platform and environment that the space station offers. And so we had the opportunity, it was a group led by at the Johnson Space Center by Principal Investigator Mark Fries. I'm one of several co-eyes from various institutions, Southwest Research and University of Colorado and Johnson Space Center and University of Maryland, et cetera. We had the opportunity, Johnson Space Center, the folks there were very interested in, getting some initial data again on this very same question of understanding the regolith of small asteroids. NASA, as you are probably well aware, is very interested in not only robotically exploring, these little worlds, but with astronauts at some point. And so they're getting anxious and antsy to better understand that environment. And so they wanted to fast track getting a payload up there to do basically a lot of some of the same stuff that Box of Rocks did. And so I was invited on to that investigation. I was very happy to do it. It's called Strata 1. It is also kind of a box of rocks. It's actually more of tubes of rocks instead of using rectangular see-through containers like I did with Bohr. Strata 1 is designed, it has four different little Lexan cylinders, little tubes, that are filled with various types of asteroid regolith simulants to watch what these materials, what these granular media do over a year of time on the space station. Do things sort themselves out as little perturbations happen to the space station? How do they sort in different ways depending on what the material is made out of? As, you know, we have glass beads in one tube. We have glass chips in another one of the tubes. We have ground up ordinary chondrite meteorite material in one of the tubes. I mean, you can't ask for a better asteroid regolith simulant because it's basically asteroid regolith. It's crushed up ordinary chondrite rock. The other tube has a simulant of crushed up carbonaceous chondrite material. We couldn't quite justify crushing up a whole bunch of carbonaceous chondrite. It's a little bit more of a precious research commodity because it's a little bit more rare, and so we decided with that one, rather than use the real thing, to take the next best approach, which was to take all the mineral components that we know are in ordinary carbonaceous chondrites and put that in one of the tubes as well.
You have Andy's got another question, and he's in San Antonio. He says, David, I'm at work, but here's my question. He says, of the people or the researchers wanting to get in line and book a suborbital research flight, are you able to say what the most popular type of experiment will be or the field representing that experiment?
Oh, that's a great question, and I think the answer is we do not yet know. Until a lot of these flights start to happen, and we start to see which of these various types of investigations are best able to take advantage of the capabilities offered by these vehicles, we won't really know. And so we're in that sort of Wild West era in terms of trying to kind of understand what's going to work well. And I think that's great. This is not meant to replace conventional sounding rockets, for instance, which, you know, can go to higher altitudes and, you know, spend longer times up there and, you know, get even higher out of the effects of the Earth's atmosphere and so on. But this is another possible venue because, if you're designing vehicles that are going to be going to space, in some cases, depending on the provider, daily, you've got now opportunities that didn't weren't afforded to you in the good old days of conventional sounding rockets, where maybe, you know, you'd spend $2 million on your investigation and you'd fly it once, and then if you were very lucky, you might have that investigation refunded and you might fly it again a year or two or three later. With these commercial vehicles, you now have, you know, a cost point that's set, you know, at least an order of magnitude lower than the conventional sounding rockets, because they're made for, you know, adventure tourists to be able to afford. Also because as you start flying more and more frequently, it's an economy of scale. Of course the flights are going to be cheaper because you're flying, you know, daily in some cases. The turnaround technologies and requirements of the vehicle are a lot cheaper. And so, you know, when you're able to do things like that, flying to space daily, through the atmosphere daily, maybe you're an atmospheric scientist who's interested in the chemistry of the ignorosphere, that part of the atmosphere. It's not a formal term, but just it's a loose term that we like to joke about. I mean, you know, it's too high to fly to. You can't get there with a powered aircraft. You can't get there with a balloon. But it's too low to sound by, you know, orbiting satellites. And so there's kind of a upper region of the atmosphere, kind of right around where many of these vehicles top out at, or fly at least near the tops of their trajectories, that they're going to be flying through daily. And if you're someone who's interested in that region of the atmosphere, these vehicles offer a great opportunity. So maybe those are going to be the ones that are most popular. I don't think we know yet, and that's the excitement of this stage of the game where we're trying to figure it all out.
It is exciting, and it'll be really great to see the other companies start actually doing flights and testing, and getting closer to reality with them.
Oh yeah, you bet. Well, I Blue is flying. It's a wonderful success. But you know, we saw early wonderful success with Virgin Galactic as well. Their vehicle was darn close to getting some of those first space flights, and unfortunately, we had the unfortunate accident.
Right.
But they're coming back. You learn from that. It's unfortunate that it happened. But that's this business, and you've got to be prepared for that mentally. And from those kinds of accidents comes safer vehicles ultimately. And so, you know, they're bounding back, and we'll be flying soon. So, you know, we're in the early days of this. Those kinds of setbacks should be expected. They should be prepared for. You plan around it, you do the best you can, and you go and you fly.
You have another email from Bobby in Helena, Montana, and I suspect Bobby is a woman, but I don't know that for sure, so if I've insulted you, Bobby, I apologize. But her question is this, and I guess you've probably had this before, and a lot of people are kind of thinking this. And this is what she says. In flying with Blue, many people were absolutely surprised at all of a sudden finding out how much progress Blue had made when they first recovered their rocket way back when. Because Blue flies under the publicity level, unlike the other companies that can't wait to open their mouths, even if what they say has nothing based in reality. But Blue is different, and we are continually surprised to see how advanced and how much progress Blue is making. Were you surprised at the progress of Blue? Did you know that they were this advanced, or were you caught off guard as well?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it is fun to kind of be a little bit on the inside of that, to know kind of what's going on behind the scenes, and know that really good stuff is coming. So, I of course, working very closely with them for the last several years, we kind of had that bit of an inside track, and knowing what's coming, and it's kind of like that with several of the other companies as well. I have to tell you, there are really good things coming. patience is a virtue in this business. And so, you know, it's very pleasing. Blue, you know, and with Blue, it's not a thing about being secretive for secretive's sake, and so on. It's just a basic company philosophy. They're very proud of the work they do, but it's a basic company philosophy that, you know, they are going to be very happy to show you what they're capable of doing once they've, you know, once they've done it, once they've tested it out and proven it. And it's not about, you know, hype and so on. It's about, you know, a serious company doing serious work, and we're going to show you what we're doing when we're out there doing it, and you're going to love it. And people are loving it because they're doing really good stuff, and they're going to continue to do really good stuff. So so I wasn't surprised. We've been working with them very closely, and it's I'm very happy to see them, you know, having their day in the limelight, because it's well deserved, it's well earned. They've worked really, really hard to get to this point over a number of years, very confidently, very deliberately. And they certainly deserve their day in the sunshine.
Can you ascertain the market or the interest in American commercial suborbital companies and space planes and ventures mm-hmm. from outside the United States, from other countries, other researchers in other far-off distant lands across the ponds? Do they want to get in on the act with our suborbital commercial industry?
Oh yeah, I think so, and I hope that they're able to get into the act with their own suborbital industry as well. There are countries up and coming they're up in here already in many cases, like, you know, Brazil, countries that you might not normally think of, and from our sometimes bloated U.S. perspective on these sorts of things, but you have countries like Brazil who are very actively developing their space program and are going to be able to take advantage of exactly these kinds of technologies to have even more opportunities to fly. So that's a good thing. When more people, more everyday people get to fly to space and experience that flight environment, experience that view of this amazing blue planet that we live on, to get that overview effect, that sensation of, we really do live on a planet all together, that can only be a good thing when more and more people have that experience. And so I think people around the world are excited about this, and I've seen evidence for it already in colleagues from other countries who are participating in this from this research perspective. In fact, one of my co-investigators, part of the very same payload I flew on, Bohr was just a component of a somewhat larger experiment on that first Blue Origin flight. The lead organization is at the University of Central Florida. Josh Caldwell is the PI. Bohr is one component of that overall payload, and one of the other components is from one of my colleagues over in Germany, who will be flying their payload soon as well. And so, yes, we do see that excitement around the world, and I hope it continues, because it's something that we should all be sharing.
Okay, we are actually at the halfway point. Can you believe half of the show has already gone by?
It's fun stuff. Time flies when you're having fun.
Absolutely. Listeners, we'll be back in 3 minutes. Our phone number, for those of you that want to give us a call, is 1-866-687-7223. We're talking commercial suborbital today, and your questions on any part of that industry or upcoming business are certainly welcome. And you can also continue to email us with your questions at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and we'll be back again in 3 minutes.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Monday Space Show program. Our guest today is Don Dr. Dan Derda, and we're talking commercial suborbital and a lot of different aspects of that industry. But first, we do have a couple of sponsors for the second part of our program. And by the way, I guess I'll have to do this on an open line show, but I'll just mention, many of you who supported us for our building our new website, and you accepted perks that called for sponsorship and banner messages and a short promo on air, plus listener voices was another one, plus hosting or co-hosting a space show program. Where are you guys? I've sent out numerous emails to the groups of you, and it's posted on the space show information blog on our website, and you're not responding, but you took these perks and you donated money to the space show to help us out, which we're very appreciative of. And now you've disappeared, and your clock is running on the perks. The first quarter has already ended. And we wanted you to participate in our show with these perks. That's why we did it. And you're nowhere to be found. Very strange, listeners. Very strange. I am having a hard time getting my grasp around that. But anyway, I guess I'll keep reminding you until December 31st of 2016. AIAA is a great sponsor, and they have five annual forums. They call their conferences forums now, so they're really conferences, but they say they're forums. SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion, and Energy, plus the Space 2016, next year it'll be Space 2017, series of events. And they bring together like-minded aerospace professionals across the industry, academia, and government for a blend of engineering, plenary sessions, in-depth foreign 360 programs, robust technical programming, and networking opportunities that jumpstart dialogues, discoveries, collaborations, and careers, and are really amazing. Great networking. AIAA's members help make the world safer, more connected, more accessible, and more prosperous. So join us. And for more information, please go to the AIAA.org. website. And Celestis, which has great historical messages that I get to read on the air, is the global leader providing memorial spaceflight services. And this is one of their messages, fulfilling the dream of space, of pioneering space entrepreneurs. Among the 24 people on board the first Celestis Memorial spaceflight in 1997 were two space entrepreneurs who tried to conduct their own Memorial spaceflights in the 80s. Buford Franklin was a mechanical engineer who worked for Lockheed and United Technologies on projects such as the Air Force Titan IIIC rocket program, the Navy Polaris missile program, and NASA's space shuttle. James Cool served as a combat pilot in World War II, flying P-47 Thunderbolts and the P-51 Mustang in 100 missions over Europe. He would retire from the Air Force Reserve as a lieutenant colonel. Both gentlemen dipped into the future with their vision of Memorial spaceflight, foreseeing a time when the heavens would thrive with commerce. Though ultimately unsuccessful in launching their company, these early efforts laid the groundwork for today's Celestis, which fulfills the dreams of these and other aerospace professionals who fly on Celestis missions. And I bet that probably none of you out there knew who Buford Franklin or James Cool was. I certainly didn't. So I thank Celestis for very informative and historical promotional spots. I think they're great. And they are, of course, a terrific sponsor, and I appreciate that very much. And now back to you, Dan. And during the break, you mentioned that you like to look for life on these little asteroids and things like that. So, and also we talked about exoplanets and some exciting new discoveries that are not all that far away relative to other far away distant suns and stars and planets. So what kind of life are you looking for?
Well, in this case, I guess it's a turn of phrase. It's more of the geologic life. I mean, you know, I remember as a child looking through some books on space that back in the early days of digging into the interiors of meteorites, and people were seeing rather interesting structures in some of them, and there was some discussion of the amino acids that are found in meteorites, right? These are the building blocks of proteins, and you start thinking about, you know, there were people who were thinking they were seeing bacteria inside of meteorites and so on. You know, nowadays we understand that indeed there are amino acids inside of meteorites. There are these same chemical processes that very readily break apart and reassemble some of the most common molecules in the universe, like water and carbon dioxide and you know, nitrogen molecules and things like that. The energy sources for driving those reactions and the raw materials for those reactions are some of the most common things in the universe. And so we now know, we're not surprised to find out that amino acids are common out there in interplanetary, interstellar space. And we find that stuff inside the meteorites. And we know that it is from the meteorites themselves and not some terrestrial contamination, because life on Earth, amino acids come in different same chemical formula, the same chemical composition of an amino acid molecule can be packaged into two different, shapes of the molecule. You could get kind of a right-handed version and a left-handed version. Life on Earth is, you know, biological processes are very picky and specific in running those reactions, and so life on Earth has picked one-handedness of that. We find the amino acids in the meteorites in both-handedness, and so we know that the stuff in them is actually not some terrestrial contaminant, but actually out there in space. Not saying that there's life in the asteroids. It's probably a very unlikely thing. It's these are the fossil building blocks of, you know, rocky materials that were, you know, the building blocks of the planets, and so. I guess the life I'm looking for on asteroids is more the geologic variety, the interesting geologic life of microgravity geology, something very different than we're used to growing up with here on the Earth. But what got me in this field, you know, as a professional researcher in the first place, actually as an undergraduate, as a high school student, a college undergraduate in the 1980s. When Carl Sagan's Cosmos came out, I was very well primed to be interested in, the concept of planets around other stars, exoplanets, and the search for extraterrestrial life. So that's actually, quite frankly, what I started out in this field most interested in was the detection of exoplanets. The technology wasn't quite ready back then yet. We were still a decade away from actually definitively finding a planet around another star yet. So, you know, by the time I made it to grad school, I unfortunately, in some ways, I kind of left that part of my interest in the field behind. I don't regret being very interested in asteroids. I think it's very exciting as well. But I guess I long for the missed opportunities of, you know, this a career in this time right now, where we're living through this absolute revolution, this paradigm shifting revolution in our understanding of the context of our planetary system. You know, we now know that we live in a galaxy just absolutely chock full of planetary systems, and it's hard not to be excited by that.
We seem to have pretty decent technology to detect exoplanets in the habitable zone. What is needed to take that detection further to say there's life there?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, we're living in this, you know, this time of detection of exoplanets, and we're just starting to transition. I mean, the next step after that, it's kind of like the discovery of asteroids, right? I mean, you know, to take it right back to the community I live and work in, you know, we're interested in the asteroids from a perspective of exploration, scientific curiosity, but also the very practical senses of understanding them as an impact hazard on our planet, and coming up in the future, for sure, they're going to be resources, economic resources for us. But before you can do any of that, you have to detect them. You got to find them first, and so you kind of go through the stage where you've done the detection, and then you start to think about characterization. Okay, now that you found them, what can you learn about them before you even go out there and start using them? So with exoplanets, it's kind of the same thing. We're living in the era mostly right now of detection, but we're starting to transition into that characterization time where you can start to learn a little bit more about the not only how big they are and how fast they go around their host star, but what are their atmospheres made out of? Does it have an atmosphere? And what is that atmosphere made out of? We're now able to start being able to do that with modern telescopes and modern detectors are able to start to pick out that faint little, those few photons of light that are coming from the planet itself amongst the, you know, the absolute torrent of brilliant light from the star itself. And so you can start to tease out things like, you know, is there methane in the atmosphere? What if you find an exoplanet someday soon that you detect, not only that you detect an atmosphere, but you start to detect things, gases in that atmosphere that are in chemical disequilibrium with each other? You know, for instance, you look at the Earth's atmosphere. If you didn't know any better, and you're looking at the Earth from afar, and you couldn't see the continents, you couldn't see, you know, the green of the jungles and stuff like that, but you were far enough away that you could detect the trace gases in our atmosphere. The very fact that we live in an atmosphere, on a planet with an atmosphere that has simultaneously molecular oxygen and methane in it at the same time, in the quantities that they have together, that is a very interesting and exciting clue and a signal that there is some very interesting chemical process going on that planet. On a biologically dead world where there's, you know, just the basic, you know, universal processes of sunlight, you know, UV light from the star and cosmic rays, all those kinds of energy sources, you're going to drive into a kind of an equilibrium state where certain molecules like to live with each other, and that's it. But I can tell you, methane and oxygen don't like to live together unless you've got some weird chemical thing going on that drives those gases into that disequilibrium. And that, of course, that weird chemical thing on our planet, of course, are all the biological processes that plants and animals are doing together. And so, you know, what you want to do is you want to move into that capability for exoplanets to be able to pick out those faint gases in those atmospheres. So we need that next generation of Hubble, that next generation of Kepler, these amazing space assets that can, you know, pick out the faint light from these planets and study them.
You mentioned one during the break that was close at 14 light years, but that still, to get information from that is a long ways away.
Oh yeah, it's really tricky. I mean, you're trying to look at the light of a firefly sitting on the rim of a brilliant searchlight, you know, that's beaming off into the sky. It's a very, very tough observational challenge. It's not uncrackable. It's certainly a crackable problem, but you know, to go beyond the sort of basic level that we're at right now, we really do start to need to look at that next generation of telescopes and detectors. The capability of blocking the light, you know, it really helps if you don't let all that light from that brilliant star that you're trying to look for this faint planet around, or at least trying to look at the faint planet around, it really helps if you don't let all that light from the star into your telescope and onto your detector in the first place. And one great way to potentially do that that's been studied is to put up basically, you know, there are ways to do that here on the ground or inside the telescope. You can use something called a coronagraph that sort of, you know, you kind of, once the light from the star comes into your telescope, you can still kind of block a little bit of it out before it hits your detector. But one way to do it is to keep the light out altogether. And one thought of that is to take that coronagraph and put it outside of your telescope. You go out in space, and you put up a huge, you know, disc out in space with a particularly interesting shape to it that is very efficient at, battling the wave nature of light that wants to make little diffraction rings around your image of your star. If you shape the little disc out there that you're using to eclipse the light of that star in just the right way, you can really bang down all that scattered light and those diffraction rings and so on to make those little faint points of light, which are the, you know, the planets around that star that are reflecting the starlight, that much more bright. And once you can do that, once you can separate and pick out, isolate, the light of the planet itself, you can do all of those magical things that you can do with spectroscopy, that almost magical ability to utilize the interaction of light with matter and all the little spectral lines that are the fingerprints, the chemical fingerprints of those materials in that atmosphere to start to tell you about what's going on there. It'll tell you things about temperatures and pressures and the rotation rate of the atmosphere and the makeup of the atmosphere. If you can do it with enough sensitivity, you could start to get at this issue of looking for disequilibrium quantities of different types of gases in those atmospheres and start that search for light, for life, even light years away. And that's an extremely exciting prospect.
Will the James Webb Space Telescope be useful for this type of search?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It would be. James Webb would be very useful, especially because that telescope is being designed to work in the infrared. One of the issues with detecting the light from a little faint planet around a distant star is that you're looking at just the light that's reflected off of the atmosphere from that brilliant star that you're sitting around. Well, stars are very brilliant in the optical part of the spectrum. But as you go into the infrared, many stars are, while they're still beaming off a lot of infrared, they're a lot fainter in the infrared than they are in the optical, the visible parts of the spectrum that we see. And at the same time, the planets that are around those stars, because they're being warmed by the sunlight from the star, they're comparatively bright in the infrared, brighter than they are from just the reflected light of the reflected optical light of the star itself. And so when you move off into the infrared portion of the spectrum, the relative brightness of the star and the planet it doesn't invert, but it certainly moves in the direction to help you be able to detect and study that planet. So the infrared's a great place to go. So absolutely, James Webb will certainly be a move in that direction, but so would absolutely dedicated exoplanet telescopes, like Terrestrial Planet Finder, maybe this design of this idea of putting this occulting disk out there in space and using it to eclipse the light of stars. That's another kind of not quite a Kepler follow-on, but it's another type of technique for isolating the light from distant planets. So these are all, these are all ideas on the drawing boards, and we would, it'd be great to, in the coming decades, to see these actually fly.
Changing directions, you have a different kind of note from a listener. I don't really know where he is. His name is John Vester, V-E-S-T-E-R. He says Eric Seathouse just published his book on X-Core. Do you know him? You and he seem to have a lot in common. As a potential X-Core passenger, have you and Dr. Seathouse crossed paths during his research for the book?
Hi, John. You bet. I know Eric very well, and I think this is not his first book. He's already written a few very good books.
500 of them. He's very prolific. Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Really good stuff. Eric's been through a lot of the same kind of training for spaceflight that I have as well, and he's captured a lot of those. They're very good and very readable books. So. If it ends up that someday Eric and I are sitting side by side on one of these vehicles flying to space, I think that'd be a very fun confluence after all these years of working together in this field.
It probably would, and he's a great person to know in person. But moving on, in terms of the emerging commercial suborbital business or industry, I should say, rather than business. Do you have any idea, or I'll accept an educated guess, since you're close to the industry, what you think the mix might be for revenue generation between suborbital research and space tourism?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question, because I think, I think my answer has probably evolved over the years. I mean, of course, early on, when the first thing when this industry was born, thanks in no small part to the whole XPRIZE competition.
Right.
It really did look like the driving motivator was going to be the adventure tourism industry, right? I mean, these are the I really do not like the characterization that I often hear that this is just, adventure thing for rich people. That's not the point of this. I mean, early on, the people who are going to be able to afford to do these flights are going to be people of a little bit better financial means. But that doesn't mean that it's made for them. What that means is that those early adopters who can afford to do it are going to drive the economy of scale to drive the price down so that the rest of us can get to go fly as well. When flat-screen TVs first came out, I guarantee you, most of the folks probably listening to this show and most of us out there walking around and shopping at the malls and the electronics stores couldn't afford to buy them. But now, after those early adopters who had the financial means to do that, I don't know that there are any tube TVs even sold anymore, right? We're all buying flat screen TVs now. And that's the analogy I like to use for this, for the economics of this industry, of this business. And so early on, yeah, I'm sure, you know, at least early on, the concept was that it was going to be about adventure tourism, and it was going to be about the kind of people who, you know, the same people who pay $60,000 to go fly, to go climb Mount Everest, right, that's the same class of adventure tourists who are going to be flying these vehicles. But, you know, once you've done that once or twice as a tourist, unless you're a really adventuresome adventure tourist, you're probably only going to do one or two flights. You know, you might fly a second flight just to see what a different vehicle is like or what a different time of the day to fly might be like. But, you know, I imagine that for many folks in that, you know, that capability, that's kind of like one of those been there, done that sort of things. Once you've done it once, you don't need to do it again. So that almost creates a limited market just in itself. But, you know, research entities, research institutions, academia, universities, research corporations, government, agencies, NASA, NSF, USGS, those are potential customers for this capability that are not going to buy a single flight or two flights or three flights. They're going to buy dozens. They're going to buy hundreds of flights. My gut sense is that I think the earliest flights are going to be driven by tourism because that's been the motivating, thing for this industry. And because many of the research dollars are driven by, you know, federal research grants, which is kind of, you know, the whole peer review process to fund those types of investigations is rather conservative. People, you know, in a world of limited research dollars, you want to be careful where you spend that money. And I think the review panels that fund these sorts of things are naturally kind of conservative. And so until we see the first vehicles flying, routinely and regularly, and until those, you know, initial early adopters, a couple of us, in this community that are working closely together are getting those initial results, it's going to take a little while for the research community to really completely flourish like that. So I think ultimately it may invert, and it may be that the research and the education, the outreach sides of this are more important than the tourism side. But, you know, I don't necessarily see it as a either or some sort of a competition between them. Anything that gives any of us who want to go to space for whatever reason more access, I'm all for that. And so if it's tourism, wonderful. If it's research, wonderful. If it's Hollywood and the entertainment industry and visual effects that drive it, that's wonderful. You know, whatever it takes to get us to space and get more of us to have that experience and be able to relate to our planet and each other in a different way, that's I'm all for it.
Of course, one of those two segments may be a more significant contributor to the bottom line than the other, depending on overhead and cost and you know, different things like that. Because you probably won't price the research ticket the same as somebody going up for their ride.
You may or may not. It depends. I mean, there are government rates for buying, you know, commercial airline. You know, the government doesn't, I mean, for the most part, the government doesn't run their own 747s. If you're a NASA employee, you don't fly a NASA jet to go to a research conference. You buy your ticket from some commercial provider, right?
Right.
And it's going to be no different, I think, as we get into more and more of this capability and access to space. It's eventually, NASA is going to, you know, I think what our federal research dollars should be doing is pressing the envelope, right? Working at the edge, doing the research and development that the private enterprise can't do. And when we are now transitioning into a world where private companies can provide the transportation for us, let's use it and let NASA use their limited dollars in the, pushing the frontier and doing the things that the private companies aren't yet ready to be able to do.
I'd like to see, and it's probably in their annual reports, which I don't get, but I could probably find one, the amount of revenue generated, say, for a major airline like Delta or United, for how many passenger miles they flew versus how many cargo miles they flew.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see how that differs. And who's the biggest contributor?
I don't know the numbers specifically either, although I do know in a generic enough sense that I think it would surprise a lot of airline passengers to know how much
cargo,
how much cargo, how much U.S. mail and things like that are being transported on those passenger flights. It's not just your baggage. There's a lot of other things that fly on those planes with you.
Absolutely, and it wouldn't surprise me if in many instances some of the routes are more profitable for cargo and mail than for people.
Wouldn't
surprise me a bit. Do you think, this is going to be a loaded question, but so if you want to dismiss it, go right ahead. Typically, in an entrepreneurial startup business cycle, you have several companies engaged in their entrepreneurial business start, getting started, coming online, you know, to develop this new market, this new idea, and then the business starts to get sorted out once the business gets going, and not all of those early companies are ultimately survivors in the industry.
Uh-huh.
So do you think it's possible that we have three American companies involved in suborbital, you have Virgin and X-Core and Blue. Do you think it's possible that when flights get going and the nature of the industry changes from this startup kind of mentality to, okay, now we're growing and getting market share and that a couple of these companies might disappear?
Yeah, I think that may. I mean, I'll say right now, it's more than just the three. I mean, there's Mastin, there's Worldview. There, I mean, you can keep going down the list. There are actually several companies that are interested in this, and that should tell you something right there. But yeah, I think it's almost inevitable that some of these will not quite make it. Others will end up being more successful.
Or they'll be merged and bought out. Or
merged
like
together,
yeah.
You know. I think it's healthy at this point that there are various means of attempting to make this a profitable enterprise. I mean, competition is good. It's healthy. It's kind of an interesting and fun competition, at least, from my somewhat outside perspective at the moment. Many of these companies are still in the, we're still in the early enough days that they have the luxury of being friendly competitors, where it's almost the sense of, well, we're in this together, right? And,
right.
You know, we all want to be successful together because it's still early on. That may, you know, that little bit more friendly environment between the various companies at the moment may slightly change as time goes on. And, I'm not going to say I hope it's the case, but in a sense, I hope it's the case. I hope we get so far into this industry that it is so successful that the competition is there and becomes real to the point where, you know, it becomes a little bit of more of a
cutthroat,
you know, PC versus Mac sort of thing. That means you're being successful. That means that all of us are benefiting from this in one way or another. So, you know, of course, it's kind of a fun environment to be in at the moment, where the companies and the, you know, we all know each other pretty personally. We're all friendly and we're all rooting for each other, I think, at this point. I say we because
a good description of the atmosphere.
So I think we're still in that point. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, one or two of these entities is probably not going to financially make it, or technically make it, or both, and that will whittle down. I think that's just the nature of the game. But you know that. To get to that point will only be a good thing, just from the perspective that means it's maturing.
You want to pick the winners and losers on air?
not a chance. Well, one, because I honestly have no way to make that choice at this point.
No,
they're all still in flight tests and so on. But even if I could, I wouldn't.
No, I know you wouldn't do that. We're down to, coming into the last couple of minutes of the show, and you do have the suborbital conferences being reconvened again. So this is in or near Boulder again, right?
Oh yeah, you bet. Yeah, I mean, you know, speaking of this industry, you're probably the best one of the best venues you can go to talk this through with your colleagues and interested persons in this community and find out what it's all about is our next generation suborbital science researchers conference, the NSRC. This is going to be, I think, the fourth of these meetings that we've held now. The first one was here in Boulder in 2010. We had one out in the
in California,
San Francisco area, and then the last 2 years we've brought it back here to the Boulder area, near Boulder, Broomfield, Colorado. It's still right here in the foothills of the Rockies, a wonderful place to be in June. NSRC 2016 is going to be on June 2nd through 4th, and It's a great place to, you know, the representatives from the flight providers are going to be there, Virgin Galactic and Worldview and Blue Origin. You're going to have researchers who are interested in flying, researchers who are getting are already funded and are getting ready to fly. You're going to have a few of us who have already flown our payloads recently, talking about our payloads. We're going to have a grant writing workshop, trying to understand how to, you know, help folks understand how to get themselves funded to go and do their investigations. We're going to have some fantastic public talks and so on. It's the place to be if you're interested in flying suborbitally, either as a tourist, but primarily as a researcher. If you're interested in research and education, seeing how those are going to be able to be benefiting from this capability, that's the place to be.
What's the website for them?
Actually, it's just very easy. www.nsrc.org, I believe. If you just Google NSRC or Next Generation Suborbital Researchers Conference, it'll be a pretty unambiguous link to that site, and we'll take you right there. You'll see our nice logo for our Boulder meeting. Registration is still open. I think we've just missed our early bird registration, which ended on Friday, but certainly folks can still register, and I encourage you to do that because it's going to be a fun meeting. I have to tell you a little bit of the inside story on this. We were having very successful NSRC meetings from 2010, 2011, 2012. Our last one was in 2013, and we've had a bit of a gap. 2014 and 2015 were empty from that regard, and that's not for lack of interest or some sort of slowdown in the industry. I have to tell you, the inside scoop is this meeting is run in large part here from the Southwest Research Institute, and a major player in the instigation of this meeting in the first place is Alan Stern, the PI of the New Horizons mission to Pluto. And as you might imagine, the years 2014 and 2015 were getting a little busy from that perspective. And so we took a little bit of a hiatus from NSRC to accommodate that. But we're back in stride and raring to go.
Is the program fixed, or can people still?
Oh, sure. No, we're doing something a little different this year. People, absolutely. You can still join on. We welcome people to come in. Abstract submission is I believe still open as of the end of today. So if people are interested in submitting an abstract for a poster presentation at the meeting, you still have a few hours left. We do have a preliminary program already together. It's actually darn close to being finalized. So that program is available on the website, and you can kind of see the program there and get a sense of what's going to happen. We're going to have sessions on payloads in the pipeline. We're going to have sessions on payloads that have recently come back from their flights and are showing some first successes. We're going to have panels discussing some of the economics of this, presentations from the flight providers like Worldview and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, for people who may have questions about, you know, how do I fly on your vehicle? If I'm interested in flying with you, what do I do? Do I go to your website? Do you have a payload user's guide? How big can my payload be? Those flight providers are going to be there to answer those questions. So it's the place to be.
Do you know if there are waiting lists to fly on these vehicles once they start flying, or how long the delay might be in order to get to your number or to when you're scheduled?
Well, in some sense, yes. I mean, I know that Virgin Galactic has sold, for instance, I think the number is well over 700 seats on their vehicle. I don't know I can't tell you the exact number, but it's on that sort of a case. I think we here at Southwest Research we're not going to be some of the first flyers of Virgin Galactic. They I think it's very important to some of their customers who signed on early that they have a particular seat number, and they're very proud of that, and they don't want to give those seats up to somebody else who wants to go and fly a box of rocks. So we're going to wait in line patiently with Virgin and fly when they're ready to fly us. I think I forgot my seat number. It's somewhere in the order of the 300s or something like that. With Excura Aerospace, currently it's a little bit of a different story with us. We have worked very closely with them to be thinking about proving out some of these payload capabilities. And so I think we're going to be some of their very first flyers with Excura Aerospace, for instance. So it varies from provider to provider. the gatekeeper, if you will, right now for getting at least funded, you know, NASA-funded flights, for instance, is NASA's Flight Opportunities Program, and they will assist the you know, the researcher in trying to find the right provider. What's the right vehicle to provide the right research environment for the investigation that you want to do? And then they will help you get that flight booked up properly. So it just depends on what you're, you know, what you're trying to do with the vehicle. So.
Beth is in Tucson, and she says, from the researcher's point of view, not the general public's point of view, is there a difference in the type of research experiment you would fly on an escort craft when they don't actually make it to space versus one of the other vehicles where they're actually going to space?
Well, for sure. For instance, to use the exact case, the example that you just raised, on an X-Corps flight where I may not be getting out of the atmosphere but might still get that early onset of some very much reduced gravity and a very clean entry profile back into the atmosphere, so a very gradual and clean onset of very low gravity, I might like to fly my box of rocks again because that's the particular environment that that particular experiment needs, and that, and so that is an example of, well, here's a vehicle that from one person's perspective that might represent a limitation, but from my perspective that's a significant advantage of that particular flight environment on that particular vehicle at the time. If I was interested in doing you know, ultraviolet astronomy with a telescope actually mounted outside the vehicle so I can get a clear view of, you know, a star cluster or, you know, aurorae in the atmosphere of Jupiter or something like that where the ultraviolet is important to me, I want to be sure I'm on a vehicle that is flying, you know, well above the atmosphere. And I might be that I have to wait for a later generation of vehicles that are capable of going a little higher, or I might need to pick a different flight provider who's getting to suborbital space in a slightly different way. So absolutely, you're going to have to do that homework for your particular investigation. So I can't tell you that, oh, you want to go fly with company X because, you know, they got the best vehicles. Well, it may not be the best for you. So that really is an investigation by investigation case.
So would that investigation by investigation hold also if you were considering worldview as compared to one of the rocket propelled flights?
If you know, if I want a, if I'm trying to do a telescopic mission where, you know, I'm just high enough out of the atmosphere to take advantage of some, you know, the opened up infrared windows, maybe I'm not high enough to do ultraviolet with worldview, but boy, I'm above most of the water vapor in the stratosphere, so all of a sudden I can do some fantastic infrared astronomy. You know what? I would sure like the capability to do those observations over several hours with worldview, rather than over several minutes with, you know, something like one of the rocket-propelled suborbital vehicles. So again, this is just another wonderful example of where all of these different creative solutions to the quote-unquote problem of getting up to space or the space environment or the near space environment is a good and healthy thing in these early days where you've got many different approaches to solving that quote-unquote problem. So. So in the case of a worldview, which, okay, maybe you're not getting the zero-G part of the experience, but you're getting the much longer time frame part of the experience. So there's a yet a different angle on the issue.
So you really kind of have a choice of a vehicle to custom fit the needs of your experiment.
And having that choice is a wonderful thing. It's
because you don't get that with a sounding rocket, do you?
You wouldn't get the time. And the problem with a sounding rocket is, you know, on a conventional sounding rocket, you're going through, I don't know how many, you know, 16 G's on launch, something like that.
Yeah, they're pretty hard.
Your specifications for designing the survival of your payload are much more extreme on a vehicle like that. You may have many other benefits by being able to get much higher or, you know, on a somewhat longer ballistic arc, but there are trade-offs too. Now you're going to have to spend more money to design your payload to be able to work under those conditions. Whereas if you were having this gentle balloon flight up to 130,000 feet, and you're going to be there for several hours, but it's such a gentle ride up that you can go and buy your parts at Radio Shack and assemble them, or, you know, That's a different story.
And sip champagne.
So there are trade-offs. There are benefits and there are trade-offs. And you just have to weigh which vehicle is best for you.
You can sip champagne, a good wine, or a scotch on the way up, right?
And with a view like that, it would be something I would certainly like to enjoy for a while.
What should I have asked you that we haven't, that I've forgotten to ask you or omitted, or that you wanted to be sure to talk about? Anything come to mind for the last 3 minutes?
I often don't like when that question happens. I can never think of anything because I always...
good.
You guys all do your job so well, I never, you know, there's nothing left. I'll close out on the note of, I can't wait to go. I mean, I've been around this space biz all my life in one way or another. I've been trying to get my little pink keister off this planet one way or another for a very long time. I've done most of the bits of flying to space other than the view itself. I've been weightless. I've done the spacesuit training and the high performance jet aircraft flying but nothing is going to beat having that first view of that thin blue ribbon, the curvature of the planet, the black, inky black sky above. That's, I think, what most of us, when we think of the space experience, I think that's certainly one of the biggest parts of the space experience is that overview effect, not only the literally the physical view, but the feelings that raises in you when you get to see your planet that you as a species have lived on forever. I can't wait for that. That's what I'm looking forward to most.
What's the highest altitude you got flying your performance craft?
Oh, I have not flown that high at all. I think the highest I've been is 49,000 feet. There are people who've flown the Concorde back in the days, literally sipping their champagne during the flight, who've flown higher and faster than I have. So from that perspective, it's not so much the altitude or the... it wasn't the altitude or the speed that I was flying at in the F-18. It was who I was flying with. It was the fact that I was flying to do a particular job at the time, the satisfaction of having planned for that job, to get that task accomplished, planned for it, trained for it, practiced for it, do it well in the environment in real time in a rather, pretty challenging environment sometimes, wearing all that life support gear and all. That's the satisfaction of all this stuff. It's not about the going higher and faster than other people. It's about flying with the people I'm flying with. And just having that satisfaction of training to do a job in a challenging environment and doing it well.
Were you a Navy pilot, or did you fly
No, this is all civilian. This is in my capacity here at the Southwest Research Institute, doing these various investigations and having these amazing opportunities to do those investigations in these on these vehicles and underwater and up in space and. Or at the edge of space, anyway. In space, if you don't count me and you just count the payload. So, it's purely as a civilian, and that's to me the most amazing thing is I never would have thought in a million years that as a civilian I would have been having that opportunity to fly some of those same aircraft that I used to just absolutely watch in awe at air shows, and then here I am getting to fly them, and that's you're living a lucky life when circumstances conspire that way.
And listeners, Dan and I have another show planned after the suborbital conference is over with. So we'll be able to hear about some of the ideas being presented and a lot more information on what's happening currently in the minds of people who are doing the industry and who will be customers in the industry, right?
You bet. And not just NSRC, but another very interesting meeting that will be taking place in Tucson in early, just the week after NSRC, Space Fest 7, which is a very... fun and eclectic meeting of collectors and artists and astronauts, space enthusiasts, and I'll be talking to you, I think, in fact, the very week that Space Fest is going on. I will be, I think, talking to you from Tucson at our next discussion, so that'll be fun, too.
That'll be fun, too. Dan, I want to thank you very much for being back with us, and very informative show and a lot of fun, and listeners, if you can make it out to Colorado, you actually fly into Denver. It's not too far away from Denver. And I would urge you to do it, and I'd love to hear from you on the space show if you do go and share your experiences and your thoughts with us on that. And again, Dan, really thank you for this, and I look forward to our next conversation in a couple of weeks down the road. Listeners, we have a lot of programming planned this week, including a special show Thursday night with Pascal Lee. The Mars Institute has produced a film that is debuting, and we're going to talk about that film. And then there is no show on Sunday due to Mother's Day. So everybody stay tuned. We're here today, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday with Hotel Mars, and then Thursday with Pascal Lee, and then our Friday space show on ISDC 2016 with the Puerto Rico group who is putting it on. Thank you all for listening and for emailing in your comments and questions, and for Dan for being with us. Everybody have a terrific week. Goodbye from the space show.